Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.
From corsets to clueless, Jane Austen's stories have never gone out of style. Her timeless tales of love, class and wit have been reimagined on screen in every way possible, and Netflix has just confirmed a brand new version of Pride and Prejudice starring Emma Corrin, Jack Loudon and Olivia Colman. And joining me now to discuss some of the best Austen adaptations is Gráinne Humphreys, director of the Dublin International Film Festival. Lovely to have you here, Gráinne.
Good to see you, Miss Byrne. Completely Austen formal.
Miss Humphreys. Yes. Listen, before we talk about Jane Austen, though, this morning we started the programme talking about Donald Trump's plans for tariffs on foreign films coming into the United States. Now, the experts we spoke to said, look, this seems half-baked, but it will have an impact on investment, and it's happening at a very important time coming up to Cannes. Do you agree with that assessment, that it will shake things?
I think it will shake things. I think it'll achieve what he always wants to achieve, which is to be the centre of attention. And I think Cannes, which I've been to for many years and love, I always thought was a bit like a bell jar, you know, that you basically blocked out the external world for the best part of 2 weeks. That's not going to happen. This is going to be the sole topic of conversation, maybe just the way he wants it. Also, I mean, I have a conspiracy theory that Mission Impossible, the final installment, is going to launch there. And I'm sure Trump maybe is aware of this information and going, why isn't this happening on US soil? You know, that there's a sense of the launch of this franchise. The idea that, you know, there are wonderful links between American and world cinema. And again, I just feel sorry for the American audiences. They're going to get stuck just watching potentially American films, you know, until this particular situation gets, you know, resolved. Because to be honest, the most exciting cinema is coming from around the world, and you have to see it in that kind of combination and in that kind of way in order to kind of see the references. And also, some of the best American films have been made, you know, by non-American directors and shot and with non-American casts. So it feels somewhat like an own goal.
That's the problem that he has with it, though, isn't it? That
it
the
is.
Production isn't happening on American soil.
Fingers crossed he'll wake up tomorrow and forget about it.
Well, we'll have to wait and see. Anyway, let's put ourselves into the bell jar of Jane Austen now. Remind us a little bit, tell us a little bit about her, who she is, her background and so on.
She's kind of fascinating because I was looking again at the weekend, and in a way it feels like she's writing from life. So she grew up the father of, or the daughter of a school teacher, a rector. She had five siblings, all brothers and one sister, and lived at home for, you know, a very long time. Didn't have a huge amount of formal schooling because she got typhus and ended up going home. And then her father died. And then there was a whole kind of, as is, you know, perfect at the time, she was born in 1778, you know, a pressure on the family as to what they were going to do. People needed to marry well. She did fall in love. I think she was in her late teens and she fell in love with a guy, but neither she had money or he had money. And they were told to basically forget about it. And that was the love of her life. She had one more proposal later on, and she accepted. And then the next day realized that after a day of engagement, she didn't love him and went and broke it off. And then unfortunately, she published four novels in her lifetime, but all of them were kind of modest successes, and published anonymously. Mm-hmm. And then she died at 41. It was really, I suppose, the books that kind of took off. Do you know what I mean? She only published six with a couple of other kind of writings around it. But what I think is fascinating is that, if you like, biography feels like many of the different pieces to the kind of key novels, you know?
Yeah, and she did use her life experience. I mean,
absolutely.
You mentioned that she didn't have any money, which is why she couldn't marry the love of her life. But she did sort of mix in those society groups,
she did,
didn't she?
She did. She herself and her sister Cassandra went to a number of balls, and there was a lot of kind of observation. I mean, apparently her sister actually destroyed a number of her letters because they were quite kind of catty and mean about family and friends, and there was a kind of protection going on. on. But she was very aware of that lifestyle and of the kind of social etiquette and of the kind of negotiating that would go on at those kind of social events. And again, the outsider may be due to her sort of social position, but also always having this keen awareness of kind of the importance of money and what it could do. And indeed, negotiated with her publisher that she would have to, you know, apparently self-publish or, you know, fund her own publishing. So she was clever and kind of smart about the role of money and what it could bring. But at the same time, as I said, very, very observant about characters. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, as we're talking, we'll go through. That's what connects with audiences down the years.
Yeah, even now, 200 years later, absolutely, we still have filmmakers, we still have audiences who, you know, are hungry to revisit those stories, which are observations about human relationships, essentially.
They are. I think they're also, I mean, as a woman, you read them and you think, oh, yes, I can see where this is, you know, this is coming from and going to. There are a lot of them are genuinely about one single thing, which is the dependence of women on marriage as a way of being economically stable or socially acceptable, and how your families can feed into that or draw away from it. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, there's a great line, I think, in, is it Vanity Fair, which is someone else's writing, but it's, she's not a social climber, she's a mountaineer. And indeed, that's the kind of tension that you have about, you know, how do you get ahead? Do you find the right appropriate husband and make the right match? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, in a way, the relevance is that still feels something that people aspire to, is to try and find the right match and the one that kind of works for your own maybe life goals.
So we have this remake, new one coming up from Netflix. Yes. There's a lot of buzz around this.
Because it's got a really good kind of look to it. I mean, I kind of feel like there's a Pride and Prejudice every generation, you know, that everybody kind of like needs a Pride and Prejudice that reflects the kind of morals or the kind of issues or focuses. So this is Emma Corrin, who is kind of fantastic. I think she's wonderful. She was brilliant in The Crown, Lady Chatterley's lover. She's really interesting, but also brings a kind of slightly kind of distance, a kind of a sort of slightly abstract kind of quality to her acting. And then you have the wonderful Jack Loudon, who I love from Slow Horses. I think he's brilliant. And I think he may, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but he'll bring maybe a slightly more warmth to Mr. Darcy. Mm-hmm. And then the Olivia Colman from Everything, who was wonderful in Everything.
You couldn't cast anybody else right now in that role, Mrs. Bennet, could you?
No, I mean, I think it doesn't feel though that role is the one that kind of dates it. I mean, you know, as we go through the kind of classic ones, you know, the Elizabeth Bennet is often, you know, incredibly beautiful and brings a kind of stature to it. But it's also her mother. Also was played usually by a kind of key character actress at a particular time of her career. And that's what really, that's the time stamp, if you like, on an Austen. You know, I think maybe, I don't know, do you want to talk about the classics?
I do, genre? And I want to talk, just wondering, as you're saying that, you know, that each generation gets a Pride and Prejudice, will this one be judged against the one that people love?
Absolutely.
The 1995 BBC TV series.
Absolutely. I mean, I go back slightly and go, there's a 1940 one with Greer Garson and Laurence Olivier. And if there was someone to be imperious and obnoxious with a great voice, it's Laurence Olivier. But 1995, which hilariously is the same year that Clueless and Sense and Sensibility came out in, which is bizarre. It feels like that was the Jane Austen year. But this was special. I mean, it had Jennifer Ely and Colin Firth playing Elizabeth Bennet and Mrs. Darcy. And then, you know, Alison Steadman, talking about Mrs. Bennet, Alison Steadman, most famous probably for Beverly in Abigail's Party, who has this incredible screech that she uses as Elizabeth Bennet's mother, the mother trying desperately to get her daughters out and married well. It's a beautiful, beautiful adaptation. It's a 6-part series, BBC. It was must-see destination television. I mean, if you weren't there,
the
what were you doing, right? Yeah. And then we have to famously talk about a certain scene where Colin Firth ends up in a lake that I think, you know, was the screenshot. It was like the Daniel Craig shot from Casino Royale. Everybody had it. Everybody talked about it. And I think what's wonderful about it is Andrew Davis was a brilliant playwright and adapted House of Cards for television. But with this, he really, I think, took something that, again, was a well-known, very well-known, much-loved novel, but turned it into something that then set sail.
Let's take a listen now.
Yes.
This is from the 1995 BBC adaptation of Pride and Prejudice.
You're too generous to trifle with me. If your feelings are what they were last April, tell me so at once.
My affections and wishes are unchanged.
But one word from you will silence me on this subject forever.
Oh, my feelings. My feelings are... I'm ashamed to remember what I said then. My feelings are so different. In fact, they are quite the opposite.
I think a rewatch is on the cards for you. Kind of whets the appetite. Let's go back and watch it.
It does. But isn't it? It's like this dent. I mean, it's funny mentioning about House of Cards, but Andrew Davis captured that kind of nearly parliamentary aspect to these ballrooms and these sitting rooms, mm-hmm. and how it's all these kind of clipped, you know, regulated engagement with etiquette and rules and
exactly.
formality. Mm-hmm. And then you have these incredible, nearly explosive sequences between the lovers where everything is terribly sharp and terse and emotion. And I can remember, you know, some of the films that we're talking about, there's always a moment where the heroine suddenly realizes what she should do and who she should be talking to or in love with. And suddenly you can see the entire audience, their hearts just explode out of them. And it's kind of this amazing, it's very, very realized to that kind of melodramas from the 1950s, you know, the Douglas Sirk films where people just, as I said, are so repressed for 85 minutes mm-hmm. and those last 5 minutes leave you in tears.
Well, let's stay with 1995
yes.
now, and I have a clip here from another popular adaptation, the Oscar-winning Sense and Sensibility.
I have described Mr. Willoughby as the worst of libertines. But I have since learnt from Lady Allen that he did mean to propose that day, and therefore I cannot deny that his intentions towards Marianne were honourable. I feel certain that he would have married her had it not been
for the money. Dearest, was I right to tell you?
Of course.
Whatever his past actions, whatever his present course, at least you may be certain that he loved you.
But not enough. Not enough.
Is anyone else thinking about Harry Potter? I can't help it. It's Alan Rickman.
It's Alan Rickman, Emma Thompson, Hugh Grant and Kate Winslet. I mean, that's the other side to these, is they're so appealing to actors and the casts are so fantastic. They're also, not in that clip, they're really funny. There's wonderful kind of irony and satire, and there's particularly in this film, it's incredibly funny. I mean, Emma Thompson, who won an Oscar for writing the screenplay, and again, I'm sure purists are probably annoyed because there's very little, I suppose, of the novel in this, but it's wonderfully drawn. The characters, as I said, the sequences that scene there, they're brilliantly drawn and they're incredibly emotional. And again, mm-hmm. I kind of feel like that's part of it. You get these casts really going to another level.
Well, there's so many ways to approach this. And you mentioned Clueless.
Yes.
Which is the modern take on Emma. Let's have a quick listen to a clip from Clueless.
The man is ridiculous. He doesn't have one unique thought in his little puny brain.
I think that there's some merit in learning form straight off.
Oh, Josh, please. He's taken our minds at the most fecund point and restrained them before they've wandered through the garden of ideas. It's just like Hamlet said, to thine own self, be true.
Hamlet didn't say that.
I think that I remember Hamlet accurately.
Well, I remember Mel Gibson accurately, but he didn't say that. That Polonius guy did.
So we take Emma and we set it in Beverly Hills.
We set it in Beverly Hills. And I mean, the thing about Clueless is that it's so rewatchable. I mean, literally, the colour, the vibrancy, the energy. And it was coming off a straightforward Emma, which was the one with Gwyneth Paltrow, which was 1995. So it feels like there's this wonderful kind of like era of Jane Austen in the kind of mid-90s when people were kind of drilling in and wondering what they could do with it. The other side to it is that I just feel like, you know, a lot of actors, that's their best performance, that you actually find yourself going back and going, oh, you know, I could think about them and other things. But seeing them again going through this transition, and also it feels nearly theatrical. Mm-hmm. You know, they're playing with a stage like sort of like aspect to it. But again, for audiences, I think half of the joy is to kind of spot who is playing which character. You know, like Shakespeare, it's the adaptation is foregrounded.
At the end of all that, Grainne, I think we need to go back to 1995 to the BBC Pride and Prejudice, watch it again before the new one comes out, you know?
Absolutely, to compare and contrast.
Absolutely. Grainne, thank you so much as always. Grainne Humphreys there. We'll take a break before the news.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.